Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's The Wonky Show. Today we're talking about what it means to be first in family to attend university, the state of NUS following its election season, and a new report out about hybrid working. It's all coming up.
And I mean, honestly, if we're talking about big battles to fight, these are the most basic elements of survival: funding, food and shelter. And anyone who doesn't think that that's a real level of the desperation we've reached for a large proportion of students, should try talking to some. Or, alternatively...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and joining me for a splash into the week of higher education are three fantastic guests as always. In Harborne, it's Smita Jambar, Partner and Head of Education at Shakespeare Martineau. Smita, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week, Mark, is the AHUA conference, a HUA conference which took place in Leeds, where I've been for the last few days. And within that, the highlight of the week was actually a really entertaining after-dinner speech by the former Registrar of Newcastle, John Hogan, highlighting the sort of progression of university administration for the last 50, 60 years, which doesn't sound very interesting, but does, you know, it was a very well-done speech, but also highlighted just how much change there has been. In what, you know, is arguably not that long a period of time in the history of universities.
In Cambo, it's Johnny Rich, Chief Executive of the Engineering Professors Council, and PUSH. Johnny, your heart of the week, please.
Well, this week, HEPI published a collection of proposals for funding HE, together with some polling among prospective students, and about which model they preferred. And there was also some cost, some economic modelling from London Economics. And this included a proposal of mine for an employer levy, and that came top in the polling. And the modelling suggests it's going to save $8 billion per cohort for taxpayers while slashing student debts and helping solve the funding crisis in HE. So I'm pretty chuffed about that.
Sounds excellent. And in North London, it's Debbie McVitie, Wonky's editor. Debbie, your heart of the week, please.
It's got to be going to the Spurs Stadium at the weekend to watch Spurs beat Leicester City in the Women's FA Cup semi-final. So we're all looking forward to catching up the final in May.
Yes, come on you Spurs. And we start the week with First in Family research. Debbie, walk us through it.
Yep. So Universities UK, along with its associated organisations, University Scotland, has launched what's calling the 100 Faces campaign. This is profiling people who were first in their family to attend university. And this campaign's got a few objectives. One is to showcase the success of these individuals, some of whom are well-known people, Beth Mead, for example, a lioness. Others who are have been very impactful in their field. You know, they're big scientists, they've done things in higher education, healthcare, and so on. And this really kind of emphasises the value that those people have gained and the impact that they've had from attending university. But it's also aiming to make the point that these successes were underpinned by a functioning student finance system, that people who are first in family tend to be more reliant on things like student maintenance, loans and grants. And Universities UK is campaigning for maintenance grants to be restored and for the student finance system to basically be better. I think this campaign, it's underpinned by polling of graduates and non-graduates. And it really, I think, does some really quite interesting work exploring the broader human values around going to university. It's looking at things like confidence, broadening horizons, the friendships and connections that people made. And it shows that people who go to university, even if they don't make top salaries, will pretty much consistently say that it was absolutely worth their while.
Lovely. Right. It's great we've got Johnny on the podcast. Johnny, I remember you talking about this issue probably more than a decade ago, possibly 15 years ago. So I want to give you kind of first refusal to discuss what jumped out at you from here.
I've been banging on about First in Family for a long time. And I, first of all, actually, let me commend Sunday Blake's article on the site about this, because she makes a really important distinction between first in family and socioeconomically disadvantaged. The two don't necessarily coincide. They overlap, but they're not the same. But she talks about other barriers that get in the way of getting in and getting on, which are cultural as much as financial when it comes to first in family. So those are important. I mean, first thing to say, UUK deserves so much credit for this campaign. Higher education has been on the back foot defending itself from political sideswipes for a long time, and it's great to see a front foot campaign that celebrates the transformative impact of educational opportunity. So, you know, kudos to them for that. This is how you do it as well. It's hard-hitting data, but backed up with deeply moving human stories. And in the data, there are some real gems. The clever thing they've done is there are 10,000 people polled, or just over 10,000, and 40% of those are people who didn't go to university. It's always difficult to get that group who don't do the thing that you're surveying rather than the ones who do. And in this group, there was a lot of a lot of clarity about the fact that financial constraints were a disincentive to going on to higher education. And I found this really interesting because for a long time, I mean, especially since the £9,000 fees came in, we've been told, well, look, it hasn't put off poorer students from going to university. They're going in ever greater numbers. Numbers are still going up, so it can't be possible to claim that the fees are a disincentive. Well, here we have people who were in that situation who were disincentivized. So we know that it's happening. And this chimes with my personal experience, which going into schools, talking to students, and then hearing, or people who don't become students, and them saying to me, I'm not going to go to university. It's too expensive. And, you know, you can try to have a conversation about how it's affordable. And that conversation is, I'm afraid, becoming less credible all the time. But even if you have that conversation about how you don't pay up front, etc., they say, I don't want to hear it. I can't go. And so, and also there's excellent research on this by Claire Callender as well, which has also been saying it is a disincentive. So we need, I think this is really important. And the maintenance grant point is very well made.
Yeah, yeah. That's not a surprise, is it, Smita? I mean, if people can't afford to study at university, then yeah, they're not going to go.
Absolutely. And I think this is, when I was thinking about this campaign, a conversation I had last week, which was at an event which was looking at a possible tertiary system, came to mind, where there seemed to be a recognition in that conversation that if we try and deter, or if we restructure the whole system so more people have other options other than university, it will open up options for certain people who currently don't have any. But I think what it will also potentially do is take some of the people who are currently going to university, you know, who've overcome the sort of anxieties that Johnny just described, maybe with some difficulty, and say to them, okay, you don't have to go to university, you can go off and do a higher level qualification or whatever. And some people will think that's a good thing. I think there's real downsides to that, because there is something you get from the university experience, some of the things that obviously the UUK campaign is picking up on, which perhaps you won't get if you are going down the, you know, the vocational higher technical route. And my fear is that we are in fact going to increase the number of people who are in the position which Johnny described, which was, it's too off-putting, I will go down this route instead, and lose some of the incredible stories that we're seeing in the UUK campaign. So yeah, I'm very worried about it. Obviously, improving choice is a good thing, but not if it means certain groups of people feel that certain choices are just not for them because of affordability or anxiety about cultural capital or whatever it might be.
I think there's something really interesting about the cultural dimension of that as well, because one of the things that comes out of the polling is that the people who've been successful and kind of gone through university, one of the things they said is that it would have been very difficult to do that without the support of their family. And I think while it is, I think, legitimate for policymakers to think about alternatives to university and think about those diversity of pathways, as you've talked about, I do not think it is. I think there's that kind of really nasty strain in the culture, in the political and media conversation that says it's a waste of time. It's not, you know, it's not going to benefit you. It's not good value. And of course, that the target of those messages is not middle class parents whose children were always going to go to university. It's the families of the people whose kids might say, actually, I'm thinking about university. And then they would say, oh, don't be silly. Sort yourself out with a trade. And of course, if that's what the kid wants, no problem. But it's, you know, you've got, if you are first in family, if you don't have that cultural capital, you do have to have that support. And you also really, really need the support of your university, because of course you're transitioning from one type of world into another. It's not about sort of teaching you how to be more middle class and more kind of culturally kind of appropriate for the context that you're in, but it is about perhaps understanding how you can make the most of those university opportunities. I think Sunday picks up this really well in her piece, where she's saying, you know, if you go in with this mindset of I'm just here to kind of learn and work, and I don't want to kind of engage with any of these wider things because that's just going to be a distraction, then you're not really necessarily going to be getting the most value out of university. There's some really good examples in the campaign of how universities are supporting first gen students with navigating some of that territory.
There's a behavioral economics aspect to decision making here as well. If you're first in family, your default is probably I'm not going to university. And it's a big leap to make a decision that goes against the default. For people from more middle-class backgrounds, for me, for example, brought up in a middle-class background, I never questioned the fact that I was going to university. I did get a job in my gap year and could have decided to throw it all in, but it never crossed my mind to not go to university, not take up that place that I had. And it would have been just as big a leap for me to decide not to go as it is for many first-in-family kids to decide, actually, I am going to go. And so there's already that barrier, and it takes so little to dent that disruption to the default. Just being pushed back into that valley of decision making is so easy. Climbing that mountain is very.
Yeah, and can I just pick up on the point that that Debbie was making about the family's role in all this, you know, Johnny, which I think sort of, you know, speaks to what you're talking about, the difficulty in making the journey. Again, you know, the sort of plural of anecdote is not data, but I remember also several years ago sitting on a commission where we were looking at different models of higher education, and some FE colleges were giving some really powerful evidence about the work they did with families to help families understand what the higher education journey for their, you know, in some cases not their child, their mother or their father or whoever was going through it, would mean for the family. And they would try to engage them in activities and so on, so that the family would understand the sort of support that their family member would need. And I do think there's an element here where universities need to think about those levels of support if they really want to make as meaningful a difference to the lives of first in family kids as they could. But we go back to the same issue we face so often, which is when finances are constrained, when the unit of resource is where it is, when you've got all these other pressures on your budget, where is the space to think, how do we really help these families and these kids work together to get the absolute best out of this experience?
And that goes back to the thing you were saying earlier about the transformative experience of, you know, there's so much more you get from the university experience. But I think that we are in danger of impoverishing that experience, impoverishing in every sense of the word, because it is getting so difficult when so many students have part-time jobs, sometimes part-time jobs that aren't actually part-time, they're full-time. So many students aren't getting that full experience anymore, especially these students who are first in family. And this is why UK is absolutely right to say that the inference from all of this is that we need maintenance grants back. They're not nearly as expensive as a policy as people think. And it would make such a difference to the people where the gain, the economic gain for them and for the country is the greatest.
There is something quite interesting, isn't there, about the way that we imagine the relationship between a student and their university as being about individuals. But if you think, you know, what often kind of happens is in the imagination, the student is plucked out of their context and deposited in a university. But actually, we're talking about the sheer numbers of first in family. You know, we're talking about half the student population here. And I think there is a kind of open conversation about how useful a category is this as a kind of to guide action. I think it's sort of helpful to understand that kind of broader context. But you know, it is much more likely that these students are going to be going to universities closer to home, to universities that are, the modern sector that are perhaps more closely woven into their local communities. And I think having a funding model, you know, I think if the funding follows the individual, but then that other side of the picture isn't recognised, that in order to kind of help that individual succeed, you know, there's a community thing going on there that might be about the family, but it might also be about the wider community as well, isn't really going to then be able to underpin a model where we continue to expand opportunity. to, you know, on an ongoing basis to people who don't have that kind of background history of participating in higher education.
Debbie, you make such a good point there about how we still somehow perceive these categories of students as anomalous. They're not the norm, but increasingly they are the norm. And you could extend that to other types of categorization as well, you know, people with disabilities or people from different racial backgrounds or whatever it might be. The model student in everyone's mind is still that very old fashioned view of middle class, you know, mobile and all the rest of it. And that's, I think our system has totally failed to keep up with that subtle change that's gone on.
And rather, I think in some ways, than sort of panicking about, and I think it is probably a problem if all the middle class kids end up in the Russell Group and everyone else ends up elsewhere, and you know, because you get that sort of, because for a whole host of reasons, you know, that it probably aren't worth going into, and you know, and you do want to expand opportunity in every direction, but if actually the kind of fundamental model of our education, increasingly in our country, is a bit more local, is a bit more community centred, you know, how do you design LLE provision, for example, lifelong learning entitlement provision, to reflect that, and you know, and enable success at the kind of broader space.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, Wonky Show podcast devotees. This is Dr. Susan Kenyon, and this week I've been blogging about why being a commuter student has become a predictor of success in HE and, crucially, what we can do about this. And this is important because nationally 40% of our students are commuters, and at Christchurch, where I'm recording this voice note, two-thirds of our students are commuters. Now, interventions to understand and support commuters to reduce the opportunity gap in HE are long overdue, but we aren't starting from scratch. In my blog, I take definitions, data, and successful interventions from transport studies and apply them to HE. Universities need to change, and we have the evidence to do this. And I'll tell you how in my blog. I hope that you check it out.
NUS is holding its annual conference this week. Johnny, tell us what's going on.
Well, I am, like many wonky listeners, a former SU SAB myself, or in recovery, as I prefer to call it. So this has a twinge of nostalgia for me. And a spring conference about to bloom, a new lineup of officers. Amira Campbell is the new president. Alex Stanley is the new vice president for higher education. And as many listeners will know, this follows a hiatus when there's not been a formal NUS president, because the last elected candidate was embroiled in an anti-Semitism row, which ended up engulfing the whole union and led to the government deciding to disengage from all interaction with NUS. I mean, I think, bad as the accusations were, I do think that there was a great deal of glee on the part of the government in leaping on any excuse to illegitimize NUS, and their disengagement was really a formalizing of what they were doing already anyway. But it did allow them to cast NUS as woke warriors from beyond the pale. And as far as they were concerned, the portion of students who felt best represented by NUS were never going to be Tory voters anyway, so characterizing them as loony lefties merely suited them far better than with people whose votes they might actually win. Anyway, I find all this really very sad, because NUS used to be a very strong and magnificent force, not only in the HE sector, but in national, even international politics. And it spawned some amazing figures: Jack Straw, Charles Clark, Trevor Phillips, Baroness Sherlock, Stephen Twigg, and of course, Wes Streeting. It wasn't that long ago he was NUS president. And NUS could command demonstrations running into the tens or hundreds of thousands. And now, NUS not only doesn't have a seat at the table, it's not even allowed to stand in the waiting room. OFS rejects using student representatives from NUS, but cherry picks those that it then chooses to ignore. Less so, I hope, in future. Hopefully, NUS, diminished though it is in power and just scraping by financially, has now seen the darkest days, I hope, and the likes of Amira and Alex can get things back on track. But they have got quite a challenge, because NUS doesn't have the democratic weight it once had, and the battles they have to face are bigger than ever. You know, there's a tightrope that they have to walk, which Aaron Porter used to do very well when he was NUS president, of being the, you know, the placard wavers, but also the sensible people in the room. There is one conference motion coming up, which I did want to highlight, which is on funding food and shelter. That's the title of the motion. And I mean, honestly, if we're talking about big battles to fight, these are the most basic elements of survival, funding food and shelter. And anyone who doesn't think that that's a real level of the desperation we've reached for a large proportion of students should try talking to some, or alternatively, talk to their democratic representatives and the NUS.
Yes. Now, I mean, NUS looks quite different, doesn't it, Debbie, to the organisation that you and I worked for all those years ago. But the candidates that have been elected this year do seem to signal us a bit of a change in direction to where it's all been in the last few years, at least.
Yes, I think from what I understand from colleagues who are closer to these issues than I perhaps am these days, my understanding is that the president and vice president of higher education, which are the two roles that the higher education sector will have the most to do with, are smart, motivated, savvy, and very effective individuals, and I think, you know, we're really looking forward to kind of seeing what they do, and I think it's really important as well. I mean, you glance through the sort of the manifesto issues and some of the things that are being debated at conference, and it looks very, very far from, you know, the world that you and I inhabited was sort of more than 10 years ago now. And I think that's exactly why student representation matters, you know, because although NUS isn't a sort of a completely representative body for all of, you know, all of student opinions all over the place, there's things that we as kind of the generation ahead, the older generation need to understand about where students' heads are. So I was really interested to see that international students and the kind of the experiences of international students are really high up in the agenda. And part of that is because a lot of international students are being elected as SU officers. And that kind of that sort of sense of global solidarity, I think, is very strong. And some of that is manifesting as a concern for international student experience, which is, you know, exactly where it should be. Johnny's mentioned the kind of that very basic stuff. But also, I think there's a really interesting polling as well out from NUS. And again, some of this is a bit opt-in, and it's a bit, you know, I would caveat it a little bit, you know, by saying, you know, I wouldn't sort of put this in my, you know, master's thesis. But, you know, students, I think, are not perhaps motivated by the sorts of things that we might have thought that they were 10 years ago. So that thing about, you know, exactly how we fund higher education, yes, it's in there, but there's an awful lot in there about, you know, about health and about, you know, the communities. Students and students aren't kind of automatically saying yes, we're absolutely here for Labour. So I think there's quite an interesting thing about political parties thinking about is there something that we want to do around the student offer? Does it actually relate to higher education funding and finance entirely? And what you know, what is, it's more kind of what's that offer to that generation? You know, this is a generation that doesn't necessarily feel like it's got the opportunities that we had. It certainly doesn't feel like it's getting the experiences that we had. And, you know, politicians, I think, need to pay attention to that if they're going to be successful.
On that subject, actually, on the politicians paying attention, there's some polling that NUS have done, or a survey at any rate, that says that 89% of students are registered to vote, and a similar proportion, I think it was 87%, intend to do so, but a third haven't decided how they intend to vote. You know, they may have done some ruling out of some options.
I do find it very implausible that 89% are registered to vote. I think that the survey is probably a good representative sample of students who are quite politically engaged.
Yeah, I thought the same.
It's a very big sample though. It's sort of 5,000 students. So I think, you know, it's again, you know, pinch of salt stuff, not, you know, completely discounted.
I think that the thing that was interesting was that a third hadn't decided, had
yes,
not
absolutely
committed their vote yet. So there are votes to be won there, by some parties at least. And politicians would do well to look at that. And in particular, also, real plea to universities, please make sure students are going to be registered to vote, because there's going to be a whole bunch of freshers arriving in the autumn. And if there's an election in the autumn, you need to move fast to help them.
Hear, hear. Definitely need to do that. I just wanted to
pick up on Debbie's point about the kind of students who might be engaged with NUS and how that plays out within institutions, because we do quite a lot of work around, this is a very long way of getting to the point, governance effectiveness reviews, and we look at how institutions hear the student voice within the institution, how governors hear the student voice. And one of the things is, well, usually the president of the students' union is a member of the board, etc., and there's information coming via the SU. But the SUs often tap into quite a small percentage of the students who are there. International students, as you said, Debbie, are now fairly well represented and do turn to their SUs. But beyond that, there are whole groups of students who aren't really engaging necessarily through the students' union. So that democratic representative voice that you talked about earlier, Johnny, I think there's work to be done within institutions to make sure it is truly representative.
I think it's also just going to be difficult. You know, I mean, since the, you know, debacle of having to essentially sack the president and you know, government sacking NUS and all of that, NUS has definitely been through a process. So it's had an external review of anti-Semitism. It's introduced some quite detailed and careful training for its incoming for all of the election candidates, and it's made commitments around cracking down on anti-Semitism. But you know, much like the Labour Party, it's really got to win back the confidence of policymakers and show that it really has tackled those issues. Because you know, unfortunately, in left-wing circles, you know, these tropes surface, and it is genuinely hard to stamp out, and organizations have to be really, really careful, if they're going to be credible at all, because any stain of anti-Semitism, I think, does just make an organization impossible to deal with.
Yeah, and before we leave the topic, I do want to flag a really good piece on the site. By Duncan Abrahart, the SU president at Leeds Conservatoire, who's written a brilliant and I found quite chilling piece about the plight of SABs in small institutions, particularly where basically you are the SU. Their situation is desperate. They need support to get the job done. They're hugely overworked. And NUS traditionally was the support for those people, but it's not so easy for NUS now. I've got to give credit to Wonky and Guild HE for stepping up to fill that vacuum, but really it does hide the need for better support from a revived NUS for those SABs who are trying to do very difficult jobs.
Now, there's been some proposed rule changes at UKVI. DK tells us what's wrong with them.
So anyone that works with international students knows that you need to monitor attendance and engagement to feed back to the government to ensure that international students are not breaching the conditions of their visa, which in the case of a study visa means that they are primarily there to study. During the COVID-19 restrictions, this was relaxed a little bit as no students could turn up in person and we were dealing primarily with online provision. Since then, a number of institutions have kept using online provision. In some cases, this is explicitly where it is benefiting students to do so. But there's been some concerns about the way this applies to international students. The UK Visas and Immigration Service are consulting quietly about a new way of working this out. The idea being if under 20% of your course is remote delivery, that's okay. If it's between 21 and 40%, you need to seek special permission from UKVI. And if it's more than that, you can't offer student route visas linked to it. This is interesting for sector policy watchers in that they've had to define remote delivery for these purposes. That's timetable delivery of learning where there's no need for the student to attend the premises of a student sponsor or partner institution, which would otherwise take place live in person at the sponsor or partner institution site. So we're dealing here with timetabled online learning rather than just sticking lecture capture up and stuff like that. But to get justification for the 21 to 40% band, you need to provide some justification linked to guidance from the relevant educational quality standard body, which in England would be the OFS, elsewhere might be the QAA. The OFS has been quite unclear about their guidance on online learning. They have veered between a kind of boosterism that we saw in Michael Barber's Gravity Assist Report and a kind of intense ministerial style skepticism that we saw in the response to the All Report or on a student facing page, which asked students to report non-compliant blended learning activity. So this is all out for consultation quietly at the moment. It would be with your international student's contact person. You got until 26th of April to respond. And any policy that comes out of this would take force in September and it would be reviewed after the first year. We did talk to the Home Office about that. They told us we keep all our policies under constant review to ensure they best serve the UK and reflects the public's priorities, which is nice.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Now, there's been a new report out about hybrid working. Smita, walk us through the highlights, please.
Thanks, Mark. So yes, so this is from prospects at JISC who have looked at the surprisingly controversial question of hybrid working. And I say it's surprisingly controversial because this is something that most businesses are grappling with in terms of what, you know, what should the future workload model be. And within businesses, there's a lot of disputes over what the right way forward is. So it's really interesting to hear about what's described as graduates' experiences of hybrid working. I say what's described as graduate experiences because I think when you read the report, they use the word graduate quite broadly. So we're not necessarily just talking about recent graduates. We're talking about graduates who've been graduates so long that they are now in senior leadership positions, etc., which in my case is a very long time indeed. But what it's showing is that there is general positivity around hybrid working. You know, people, I think, are recognising that that is now part and parcel of the life of work in the future. However, it does break down and it very much depends on where you are in that journey from new entrants into the labour market all the way through to senior leadership. So some of the things it highlights, which is not going to surprise anybody, is your positivity towards hybrid working is going to depend on things like how good your home working environment is. You know, those of us who are lucky enough to have our own offices in a very different position to people who are perched in their bedrooms and working. It's going to depend on what level of learning you feel you need to do from colleagues. So younger graduates, you know, feel that there is an element where you really only learn by being in an environment with senior colleagues and working together, so very much in the office. There's an element to which you're dependent on the workplace to generate your community, your friendships, and so on. So although really overall positivity and generally positivity across all the groups, there are some quite thorny issues about how we make sure that younger graduates, people entering employment, get all the benefits that some of us took for granted when we were in the office, while still having the flexibility, etc., of hybrid working. And then the final point I would make is it does also highlight, a little bit like the conversation we were having about what's the typical student, that people with disabilities, people who are neurodiverse, etc., they may have a more positive approach to hybrid working than others. And there are, you know, obvious reasons for that in terms of accessibility and an environment in the office. But we shouldn't generalize. We should take people as they are and find the right model for them. And there's no reason why that shouldn't happen in a modern workplace.
Mm. I mean, this is fascinating. And there's going to be lots of downstream implications for universities, aren't there, Debbie? Because eventually these graduates, you know, or maybe very soon after graduating, they might want to work for universities. And, you know, universities, most major universities have been built with, you know, everyone coming to the office in mind. And so there's an awful lot of space that in the future might not be needed.
It's true.
My theory.
It's true. I think I think we should probably differentiate between remote working, which of course we do and enjoy, and we kind of fret a little bit about whether our kind of more earlier career staff are kind of getting what they need from us. And of course, you know, as a business, that's what we should be doing. And of course, universities will be thinking about those things as well. And the things that universities might be thinking about in terms of preparing students to graduate into that space where they may have to be a bit more intentional about how they divide up their time between home and office and be able to engage in conversations with their employers about what their preferences are, and sort of understand the implications of the preferences that they are expressing. So this reminds me very much of the ongoing debate inside higher education about how you deliver the curriculum, because is it better to say, let's give students lots of choice, and you can kind of, you can attend a lecture, you can get it afterwards. Or is it better to kind of say, no, actually, there are things you need to be here in person for, even if it's really inconvenient, but you know, we see all kinds of benefits that kind of come out from that. I think what this is quite a sort of abstract conclusion that I draw, but a lot of the curriculum debates that I engage in the sector do keep bringing me back to this place, which is about teaching the ability, you know, teaching that level of self-reflection that allows you to be quite intentional about how you organize your time. I think the kind of meta point here is that we're all moving from a world in which things were organized a certain way and that was how we did them, to a world in which we have a greater degree, if we work in a professional role, this isn't universal, of course, we have a much greater degree of flexibility and choice about how we organize our working lives on both sides, and much more power of negotiation, because of, especially if we happen to hold skills that are in very high demand. So the consequence, you know, and I think on balance that's a better thing, but it comes with an awful lot of downsides. But I think it requires also a different skill set from the people involved, which is to be able to negotiate these things in a thoughtful way, to manage our own motivation and emotional state, and be sort of sufficiently self-aware to realize if we are not able to be productive in certain contexts, and you know, what other contexts we're productive in, the different kinds of productivity that are created between sitting in a room by yourself and being with colleagues and doing things together. And I think all of that, you know, being able to recognize those things and have that meta conversation becomes actually a really, really important modern skill. And that, I think, is something that universities are beginning to wrap their heads around in quite interesting ways in the curriculum context. It is one of these universal transferable skills, but of course, it's going to mean something different in different industries and different subject areas and so on. And this is where I think you get into some very interesting spaces.
And Debbie, I think what has particularly depressed me, because I think you're absolutely right about how this has to be built into how we deliver the curriculum, what the curriculum contains, what skills we're teaching people. But the experience after COVID, and of course, COVID wasn't a great example of any of that because it wasn't terribly intentional. It all just had to be done in reaction to an external trigger. The sort of the knee jerk reaction of sort of some politicians that really everything had to go back to exactly how it was and anything else was a deficit to what it previously was has really set back the cause massively, I think, rather than building on all that hard work that was done to say, okay, how do we now embed this in a more measured, thoughtful, sustainable way. Institutions were coming under pressure to go back to the old model. And I'm hearing regularly from universities that, you know, very much as you were describing, Debbie, people who aren't necessarily residential students are saying, well, I don't want to have to travel in for a lecture because it costs me a lot of money. I haven't got a lot of money and I would rather be able to do things in a different way in my own time. So their experience is actually being denuded by this kind of fixation with in-person, you know, everybody back all the time.
Kind of. And I think there's a few things going. One is I think universities are genuinely struggling to figure out how you offer a good learning experience to this kind of diversity of needs. And I think that is a genuine challenge. And, you know, there's a kind of rebuilding from the ground up job going on. And there are often really strong cases for people to be present in person for certain things, but then you just need to know what those cases are and be able to make and understand that case and design things in a way that remain accessible, even if that's how you're doing the curriculum. But I think also that one of the things that's driving politicians is, and kind of commentators generally, is a sort of desperation for the rules to be reset. You know, like the idea that we have to sort of say, look, hybrid is okay. No, hang on, it's got to be in person. No, fully remote is fine. You know, sort of. and the kind of point is that there isn't a kind of fixed set of rules. There's no best way to do work. That's crazy, it depends on the work, depends on the individual, depends on, we are genuinely kind of trying to build our working lives, and to some extent the same applies in universities and for studying and work, and on a case-by-case basis, and people's ability to be flexible and do that sort of case-by-case work and thinking is the thing that's going to make that work, rather than people sort of saying, oh, I thought the rules was this now, and then it turns out it doesn't work for everybody, and then says, oh, well, that doesn't work for everybody, so we better do the other thing. And that's just a silly way to organize anything.
At the risk of repeating what you both have just said, which I absolutely agree with, we found ourselves in this situation because of COVID. I mean, remote and hybrid working were on their way anyway. I've actually been working hybrid most of my career, and it's worked pretty well for me, but the process was accelerated by COVID, and now we find ourselves in a situation where there are a whole bunch of, especially young people with a different set of expectations. We've got a whole lot of rapidly put together solutions that have been cobbled together in without any real strategy or thought, and there are going to be some unintended consequences. You know, some things about hybrid working or remote working are much more convenient and everybody loves them. But what we love isn't always what's good for us. And sometimes it is. And so we need to try and work out what is the best part of this. What is the stuff that might be doing us some genuine harm in the long term? I'm thinking particularly of the questions around housing and the expectation to have somewhere to work. You know, it goes back to Virginia Woolf and a room of one's own. But also it's about fuel bills and the costs put on, especially younger workers, to have a place where they can work. And also the well-being aspect, being left to work for several days, where if you live on your own, the only interaction you might have with people is going to be through a screen. And we are perhaps doing something to the human psyche by training ourselves that's how you meet people, that's how you interact. I'm sounding like an old fart now, worrying about screen time and everything, especially since I spend most of my life on a screen.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks so much to Smita, Johnny, Debbie and Michael who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. I'll be here again. Until then, stay wonky.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.